Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Oh, welcome in. You are listening to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck, and I am your host for the first hour. Boy, it was another very interesting and very volatile week for a wide range of markets and sectors, something that we are going to try to cover the best we can in this first hour. I'm kicking off the show with Axel Merk, President and Chief Investment Officer at Merk Investments. So, Axel, it's been a couple months since I had you back on the show, and as I said, it's been a volatile last week and last few months. We've started to see fears creep into a lot of investors' heads, whether that's from simply volatile U.S. equity markets or the fact that we have yields crashing, central banks around the world showing signs that they're also worried. Let's start off with the bond market and what yields are doing. In the U.S., yields have been falling very heavily this week as we had the 10-year touch below 1.5%. We even had a very short-term inversion of the yield curve on the 10-2 spread. Let's get some of your comments. What do you think about yields that just seem to continue to go lower around the world?
Sure. Well, before I go there, let's take a step back. Let's remember it is August, and anybody in their right mind is probably at the beach. And the reason I say that is that we've had such volatility that a lot of people have just thrown their hands in the air. Indeed, we know that many institutional investors just don't try to outguess the markets anymore. They just do a benchmark strategy. And so what you have is you have less volume in August. You have a lot of algorithms that are in the market, and it is quite possible that they overreact to some news. And then, of course, the moment that markets move, we scramble to try to find an explanation for that move. And this week we had, for example, on Thursday, the St. Louis Fed President Bullard came out, and the markets had a fairly dramatic reaction to it, meaning bonds were rallying and pricing in over 50% chance of a 50 basis point rate cut in September, whereas 2 days before, for a moment, it was only an 11% chance of a rate cut. Those are extraordinary moves and not really warranted by fundamentals. And so we just have to keep that in mind. So in the meantime, you mentioned the yield curve and used technical language that a few months ago, even, you probably wouldn't have dared to mentioned to a general audience, whereas now everybody knows about it. And I mean, for context there, the Federal Reserve over the last decade has manipulated so many different metrics that there's so few that still have some sort of clarity or predictive power. And so everybody is grabbing onto this yield curve because historically that has been a predictor. And so now everybody says, oh my God, we have a recession because bonds have rallied. I just like to have everybody maybe take a deep breath and say, well, where is it that we really are? I heard one of the more intelligent commentators I heard is that, well, exporters are suffering, but importers are doing just fine, and referring to countries like Germany and China are suffering. But in the U.S., most of the metrics you look at have been quite all right. The U.S. consumer is doing just fine. Not sure whether I'm answering your question, but that's my answer.
Let's also talk about that then, the balance between the U.S. that still is producing some fairly decent economic numbers, but when you compare it to what's happening in China and what's happening in Europe, they're really struggling. And that's been an argument of why the U.S. dollar might be doing better and why still money is looking at U.S. markets in a more favorable light. Do you think that that trend can continue, though? Can the U.S. buck the really declining trend in a lot of other countries?
As an asset manager, I look at the world in risk scenarios, like what is the risk of a recession? But the other risk that nobody talks about is the risk of an overheating economy. And me just mentioning that, your listeners are probably going to kind of say, what program do I have the right year tuned in here? Let me just walk through that positive scenario. And I'm not saying that's my mainstream scenario, but I am concerned that nobody is even looking at that. We do have an election coming up, I might remind you, next year. Historically, a president and our President Trump is no exception, would like to not have a recession. And the one lever that he has is he can increase tensions on trade, he can also reduce tensions on trade. And so it is conceivable that he would reduce the tension on trade. My baseline scenario had been that he makes a big fuss about China, but then at some point he shifts focus and goes after France. And he didn't like the digital tax that France introduced and has started to tweet about French wine. Now, French wine, as much as we may all like it, doesn't really move GDP. So if he tweets about French wine, he can appease to his base, where it's not caused greater damage to the wider economy. And clearly, in the meantime, of course, the actual scenario has been that, yes, he's ratcheted up the tension against China. And the bad thing from an economic point of view is that that creates business uncertainty, business investments may be down, and so forth. Similarly, obviously, if you are an importer or exporter, you might be hoarding or put in orders early or whatever it is, and that creates some uncertainty. But we have very low unemployment. And so let's assume now, just theoretically speaking, that in the coming months, trade tensions are going to abate. And then we got these interest rate cuts. We are setting ourselves up potentially for a hot economy heading into the election. Now, again, that's not my baseline scenario, but it is a risk that's worth considering. Now, the other side of that is the economy falling off a cliff. Well, historically, when we have a recession, the consumer spending doesn't vary dramatically unless we have a major, major shock. But what can change is inventory levels, business investments. And there, by all means, we have cyclicality, especially since Mr. Trump is forcing us to do so. The question I have in this context, what on earth can the Fed do about any of this? Financial conditions are easy, super easy. Access to credit is available to companies that are created junk. And so cutting rates does not fix trade policy. So yeah, it may be that the economy is heading down. It may be that, that business have trouble selling into China because of retaliation. But there is nothing the Fed can do about it other maybe than move asset prices higher.
Well, let's talk about what the Fed is doing, though, and that is now, I know they don't want to say that they're doing this, but really seems like they're going down the road of more a series of rate cuts, even though we just had one rate cut. Now with the markets pricing in, yeah, 25 basis point rate cut, but also potentially a 50 basis point rate cut. I don't think that's going to happen, but market expectations, boy, are those ever volatile as well. But that being said, the Fed is no longer hiking rates. It's no longer unwinding its balance sheet. It does seem to be moving into a more easy policy. But as you even said, that doesn't fix the economy. But can it put maybe a Band-Aid, prolong any sort of significant weakness or significant sell-off in the markets and the general economy?
Well, what is the role of the Fed, right? You mentioned about market expectations are volatile. Well, the reason market expectations are so volatile is because the Fed is volatile in how it expresses itself. Mr. Powell, the Fed chair, has said he's monitoring now political developments, and increasingly so. He doubled down on that. Well, what the heck does that mean? Does that mean he is going to be tweet dependent? Does that mean he's going to try to predict tweets with his insurance cuts or whatnot? The reason, and I'm of course semi-cynical in that commentary, but it's a very serious matter. The Federal Reserve controls the benchmark of the risk-free rate, the officially risk-free rate that the treasury rates or Fed funds rates more specifically, and everything else is priced off that. But if the official policy is now to be tweet dependent, of course the market has knee-jerk reactions. And guess what? Mr. Trump heard that as well. And the day after the most recent Fed meeting where Mr. Powell said he's going to react more to political developments, Mr. Trump doubles down and escalates tensions. So he's egging on Trump to escalate the trade war. And at the same time, of course, there's this feedback loop that Trump is trying to coerce the Fed to do something. The Fed is screaming, oh, my God, we are independent. But there is another route, by the way. The Fed could say that, hey, we are data dependent. Remember that boring term? We're going to see how the data come in. And instead, they want to preempt the next tweet. And sure, maybe there's a reason for a quote-unquote insurance cut. But when we've had insurance cuts in the past, remember long-term capital management in the late 90s? That's when we had an insurance cut. It was because you needed to potentially buffer what happened in the financial system. Again, a rate cut doesn't change tariffs that may or may not be introduced. And And so to me, it is very questionable whether this policy of losing patience, watching political developments, creates stability or uncertainty. And so what the Fed can do is have a communication strategy. I seriously doubt right now that they have, let's put it this way. Mr. Powell has not yet learned how to herd the cats at the Fed. You have all these different voices, and Mr. Powell himself, I don't think, is helping the matter with how he communicates.
Yeah, unfortunately, the Fed seems very reactive right now, and that, I think, adds to some uncertainty and uneasiness from investors. Can we also talk about, though, what other central banks are doing? Because the ECB, they seem to be going down the road even more so than the Bank of Japan. The Bank of Japan's been doing it forever. China keeps on pegging the yuan a bit lower, and Trump keeps snapping back at that. But it seems like all these central banks, again, are just moving in this easy money policy, which is a bit confusing because it really hasn't seemed to work. It hasn't sparked inflation, and it hasn't led to some sort of stability.
Well, how many hours do we have? Let's talk about some of the bigger elephants out there. European Central Bank. As we talk, Olli Rehn, the head of Finland, they came out and said, well, maybe we want to have a major package and and Bloomberg called it a shock and awe announcement in September on stimulus and rate cuts. Remember, in the Eurozone, they're already negative. They're thinking about differentiating rates depending on the type of borrower, and then also increase bond purchases, except they already own a lot of things. So it's not so easy, but to kind of be forcefully dovish. Now, keep in mind, in Europe, we have Madame Lagarde, the current up to now head of the International Monetary Fund, come in. And we know quite little about her on the monetary side. And I may have mentioned on your program, I am most skeptical about how she is going to run the ECB. She did a good job, I think, at the IMF, doing what they're supposed to be doing, meaning when the Eurozone debt crisis was, she represented the role of the IMF properly. She's been vocal about women joining the workforce, and not so much from a political point of view, but from an economic point of view. When you have a greater percentage of women, that's better for GDP growth. But, and it's a big but, she's also used the IMF as a political platform, notably when she considered running for president in France. And when it came to major monetary issues, she had, in my view, the completely wrong answer. She blamed big tech companies for the wealth gap in the world, rather than low interest rates. So the argument being that obviously you need a higher education to make money, and there's a validity to that. But she was a strong proponent of wealth redistribution and other highly socialist policies. And the question is, how does that translate to future monetary policy? So that's going to be very interesting to watch. I've gotten far more cautious about the euro, let's put it positively, since her nomination had been announced in early July. Now, the other big elephant in the room is China. And the Chinese obviously get a lot of heat from the president. The Chinese have actually been extremely prudent. What you want to do usually when you're faced with an economic slowdown, you want to cut rates. Well, the Chinese haven't done so. They have cut other things, reserve ratios for banks, other roundabout ways to try to stimulate the economy while trying to prevent a currency debasement. Now, obviously, that has happened a little bit, and they're getting a lot of heat for it. But if anything, they're manipulating their currency to be stronger. And so they have actually been the grown-ups in the room trying to be as cautious as possible as they've moved forward.
All right, Axel, let's talk about where money has been flowing, more from the investment side of things. We've seen a lot of volatility in U.S. equity markets. It was just a couple weeks ago that a number of these broad averages poked their heads into all-time highs. But in no way are we getting, let's say, a screaming higher market. But we have seen a lot of money move into more defensive or safe assets. We have obviously treasuries, they continue to just scream higher. Gold has even been moving higher. More REITs and defensive stocks continue to move higher. Do you think this is a longer term trend that investors can jump on board with?
Yeah, we had an interesting discussion in the office earlier today where we talked about, well, what is a safe asset? And clearly, if you need cash in the next 2 years, well, cash is a lot safer than gold, right? Gold fluctuates in value every day. And if you have a fixed expense in 2 years, you might not want to put that at risk. So gold is as much of an opportunity and a risk as it is a quote, but it is acting as a safe haven. And the flows that we have seen and what we've observed in the markets, investors aren't really interested in cash right now. They have a lot of stocks. Those stocks have gone up. And so rather than selling the stocks and potentially pay gains, the capital gains tax and things like that on that, what they're doing is they're adding a gold component or even a gold mining component. So if you add a gold mining component to your portfolio, you're adding actually an extremely volatile component to a portfolio. But investors are flocking towards that because with a fairly little addition, you can get a lot of diversification. Now, whether that's safe, I don't know whether investing in gold mining companies is safe. That's not the attribute I would use. But that's the sort of thing that investors are doing right now. That's different from 2009, where people were so shell-shocked that obviously there's always a group that likes gold, but a lot of people just pulled the money out and were completely on the sidelines. So the confused investors is trying to have it both ways. They continue to have stocks and then add something else that's the diversification to it. So we are far away from kind of any sort of panic. And as we know that, I mean, every day that the market goes down, the next day it seems to go up just as much.
Yeah, we do still have that buy the dip mentality for U.S. equity markets. But it does really sound like what you're saying is that investors are starting to hedge their bets when it comes to long exposure for risk on or U.S. equities. Is that a healthy environment? And you know what? Just how long can that last?
You tell me. I mean, we've had a 10-year bull market. So yes, it can last. The question, though, is again going back to assessment of risk, right? What are the different scenarios, how this can play out? Now, the other thing is that there's always this saying, oh, you said buy the dip mentality. Well, when should you buy the dip? In my view, you should buy the dip if you have the ability to do so and if it's compatible with your investment outlook and your risk outlook. Now, that's a very abstract way of saying it, but basically, if you've ride the wave, if you've gone up on the wave and you've got more and more stocks in your portfolio because relative to quote-unquote safe assets, that risk portion of your portfolio has grown bigger and bigger and bigger. And then if you're on top of that, because you feel so wealthy now, have increased your expenditures, well, guess what? Let the market plunge and have a bear market. You do not have the resources to put more money to work, and it doesn't matter how many pundits will tell you that buy the dip. You're going to be scared, and you're going to be pulling money out. Whereas, if you have a more prudent approach, let's say you have a balanced portfolio, put some stocks and bonds, and it doesn't matter whether you have gold in it or not, but the point is that you rebalance. As you rebalance, that as your equities go up, you're selling, right? And you put more money on the side. And so then when the markets plunge, then you have money to put to work. And then the buy the dip is a perfectly reasonable approach. And so similarly, it doesn't really matter of where we are right now. The thing is, anybody should have a strategy and execute on that strategy rather than just going along for the ride and then something bad happens and says, oops, what do I do now? Because if you just go along for the ride, odds are you're caught off guard and you're going to be selling at exactly the wrong spot.
Yeah, and the most, I think, scary thing is that this is already a 10-year bull market. So hopefully you do have some gains, and hopefully you have been at least putting some money on the sidelines. Let's just wrap it up with a quick comment on currencies. You alluded to earlier that you're not overly excited and kind of bearish on the euro. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but does that mean that you think the U.S. dollar has room to run to the upside?
Well, as I look here, the dollar index I have at 98.2, and we've been talking about the stronger dollar, and it's been stronger than that, it's been weak on that, it's been just as volatile as everything else. Now, the dollar index obviously heavily influenced by what's happened to the euro, whereas gold has gone up versus all currencies, right? And so where central banks around the world are scrambling to have negative rates and consider cutting rates, even the Reserve Bank in New Zealand has said, oh, one day maybe we have negative rates, right? So they all want to prepare everybody else that if indeed the U.S. cuts rates, we may also come down. By the way, I continue to think that I mentioned to you the hot economy topic. That might be an exaggeration, but I don't think the economic data in the U.S. are coming in so bad. So I do think, but at the same time, I do think that the Fed will continue not to have a kind of a straight answer as to what they want to do. And so as economic data may come in mixed and as the U.S. may continue to cut rates, I think there is a good chance that volatility is going to persist. And the same applies then, of course, to other currencies, right? We got in the Eurozone, I mentioned, maybe they come out with a big bazooka in September. Well, who knows? Maybe it's a water pistol after all. And then we have a change in presidency there at the ECB. And so there's going to be a lot of uncertainty about these things. Again, I think one should have a coherent plan and the dollar has had a rally for many, many years, and we are in an easy cycle, so I wouldn't put my eggs into the dollar. But there is the only thing you can have is a plan of how you want to diversify around the world potentially, and maybe really do the thing I said at the beginning, go to the beach and maybe not look at all this stuff all the time, because you're just going to go crazy looking at every headline.
There's the takeaway. We're going to leave it at that, Axel. I think that's probably the best strategy for all these people that have been getting stressed out on this volatile and wild swings that we've been seeing for a wide range of sectors. I know the gold bugs are excited, but there are still a lot of things that need to be considered in terms of where money is flowing and still the ability of U.S. equities to hang in there quite well. Axel, great chatting with you. It's always great having you on the show. I hope that you have a great rest of your weekend.
My pleasure. Have a good one.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Oh, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. Bringing back on Mike Larson. You can find Mike on Twitter by following him at RealMikeLarson. He also writes the Safe Money Report. And Mike, one theme that we have seen, I guess, kind of throughout this year, which is a big discrepancy from especially 2017, is volatility really hitting U.S. equity markets. We even saw it earlier in the week with the whole pushback of trade tariffs, and that provided at least a short-term boost to the markets. But it seems week after week we're getting volatility, not just in the U.S. equity markets. We've even seen volatility come into some of the safer assets, with precious metals moving in some, still an uptrend, but still some pretty wide swings day to day. What do you have to say about this volatility that has really perked up and seems to be sticking around?
Well, sure. I mean, if you go back to sort of where I think we transitioned out of the clear, obvious, powerful, widespread, almost every sector participating bull market that started in 2009, back in January of 2018, we started to transition out of that. I mean, if you go back and look at what happened in the January, February timeframe, we had our first bout of volatility where the stock market fell sharply, volatility spiked, and so on. There were a couple of days, and I forget, the worst Dow day was something like down 1,000 points, or there was one day where it was down 700 and then finished up 400. I mean, there was some crazy market swings that we began to see in that sort of January, February timeframe. And the market sort of found its footing and you know, started to run up again into October of last year. And then we had the second round of significant volatility where the stock market fell from high to low, roughly 20% on the Dow and the S&P, amid some fears of the Fed screwing up and future recession worries and so on. So what we're seeing now is nothing new. It's been all part and parcel of this transitionary market. Again, we're transitioning out of a clear, powerful bull market into sort of what's been a sideways market with wild swings. And at the same time, we're getting a lot of evidence in the bond market, for example, which is screaming that the U.S. economy faces a significant slowdown and potential recession in 2020. And that's why I think the market is just, the stock market is succumbing to these wild swings, because it's news driven on a day-to-day basis. I mean, you mentioned the tariff issue, and you know, all of a sudden one day it's trade war on, the next day it's trade war off, and that causes these wild day-to-day swings. But the broader trend is clearly being driven by worries about recession, worries that the Fed hiked too far, you know, just like it did at the peak of the last couple of cycles, and worries that, you know, the global economy, even outside of the U.S., is in some pretty lousy shape as well. So I think what you're seeing is investors look for safety. You know, even as the stock market, the S&P 500, has basically gone nowhere since January of 2018 with some significant swings up and down. Gold is clearly in a powerful new bull market to me. Treasuries are clearly in a powerful bull market ever since October. You know, yields are plummeting, gold prices are soaring. And within the stock market, it's over and over again, it's these safe money sectors. It's things like utilities. It's things like REITs. It's things like consumer staples that are dominating, while things like materials, transport, small caps, banks, you know, financials, all of those sectors are either underperforming or actually losing you money, which again is just the market saying, look, this is no longer an expansionary economy. This is no longer an area where it pays to take a lot of risk. It's a kind of market where you've got to be looking for havens. You've got to be looking for new types of profit vehicles that have totally supplanted the old ones. You know, two, three years ago, you could just almost throw a dart at the wall and make money. And that's definitely changed now. All that, those super risky FANG stocks, many tech stocks, many other sectors that were offensive sectors are underperforming, and many defensive sectors are outperforming. So that's, you know, that's the market environment we're in. And that's why we're seeing all this volatility.
Well, and that's the thing. 2 years ago, if you threw a dart at a wall with all kinds of risky stocks, yeah, you could make money. But now you can almost throw a dart at a wall with all the safe defensive plays, and those at least seem to be quite stable and even moving higher. But as you talk about recession fears, let's talk about the yield curve as well. We've already had an inversion on some of the different time frames within U.S. yields, but that 2-10 or that 10-2 years spread, it continues to creep closer and closer to inverting. I think we all assume that it will invert relatively soon, but you never know. The overwhelming aspect is that the Fed doesn't seem to have any control over the long end, and they continue to focus on the short end, and they continue to cut the short end. So what about the yield curve? Is this one of the things that you're watching closely that has you thinking a recession is around the corner, whether it's 1, 2, 3 years out?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, I cut my teeth. I started out by following interest rate markets at a company called Bankrate.com before I joined Weiss Ratings, Weiss Research. My interest, pardon the pun, has been in the bond market specifically and how it relates to what's going on in stocks. I think all too many investors ignore that kind of stuff because they think it's boring. I mean, yield curve, yield schmurve, you know, what does that have to do with earnings for Facebook? But the problem is you can really get a clue for what's coming in terms of big macro moves and changes in the economy and changes in you know, sort of credit risk and how, you know, whether investors want risky or less risky assets and so on by watching the credit market. And, you know, we've already had the difference between the yield on the 3-month Treasury bill and the yield on the 10-year Treasury note. That first slipped into negative territory or inverted territory back in May slightly, then it bounced out of it, then it fell back into it in sort of the early June timeframe. You know, now we're going on, early June timeframe. So now we're going on basically almost 3 months, give or take, or 5 months, depending on if you measure it that way, this curve, part of the curve has been inverted. Now the 2-year, 10-year Treasury curve measure is within a couple of basis points of it inverting. So again, these are the kinds of things that we last saw in 2007, right before the last recession began. When did we see it before then? Back in 2000, before the previous recession began. When did you see that happen before that? Back in 89, before that recession began in 1990. You know, there's a reason this happens. It's the bond market's way of saying there's less credit demand. Central bank's gone too far in hiking short-term rates, which is kind of breaking the economy, if you will. And there's just an intense demand for safety, long-term bonds, 10-year treasuries, 30-year treasuries, whatever. That's, you know, it's intense here in the U.S., and that's why these curves are inverting. But it's obviously even more intense and ridiculous, really, when you look at what's happening overseas. I mean, you know, you look at some of the yield curves for these countries in Europe, Denmark or Switzerland or, you know, much larger markets like Germany, you can't find a positive yielding bond. the Swiss government issues 50-year debt. It doesn't pay a positive yield. I mean, you're literally losing money for a half century if you buy this thing at current prices.
That's
so
crazy. Make any sense? It goes against everything we've learned.
It makes no sense to me. It makes no sense to you. I mean, would you, if your neighbor asked you for $100 and said in 50 years, I'll give you back $99, I mean, who would do that kind of thing? It doesn't make any sense. But that's what's happening in parts of the bond market. So it really tells you that you're having, even the policy, monetary policy, that's supposedly stimulus. They always say, oh, we're going to do stimulus, isn't stimulating anything. I mean, if it were, bond investors would be running scared of stronger growth, stronger inflation. They'd be dumping treasuries six ways till Sunday. And the fact that they're not tells you, again, that there's real risk out there. People want safety. They're not, credit demand is weak. And therefore, the economy is probably headed for rough times. So, I think as an investor, it behooves you to pay attention to all this stuff going on in the bond market, because I think it absolutely is impacting the stock market, and that impact is likely to get worse over time the longer these warning signs persist.
So it's something that I've talked about a fair bit to a lot of the, let's call them precious metals focused investors and analysts. But a lot of the argument is being made that this is still early stage, not just for precious metals, but could be for many defensive sectors as well. The bond market, that's been running well for a while now. But how do you classify some of these defensive sectors and the stage that they're in terms of a bull market?
Sure. Well, you mentioned sort of the defensives versus the offensives, and I'll go back to what happened in 2000. We were back then we were in a transitionary market too, where, the bull market of the 90s was giving way to sort of a transitionary year, and then we slipped into a bear market. In the year 2000, the REITs and utility stocks were up about 20 to 25% on average, whereas the average tech stock was down 45%. That's a spread of what, 60, 70 percentage points in terms of performance? I mean, it's huge. Now, you can say, tech's not collapsing the way it did in the dot-com bust and so on. But even now, the outperformance of some of these safer sectors is only, 10, 15 percentage points over the S&P or over some of these offensive things. So, the spread is good. You're in the right stocks if you own that stuff. But could it get even better? That's my bet. Absolutely. So I think that you still want to stick with those kinds of investments. They've come a long way in a short period of time. You're due for corrections and so on. But I don't think you abandon the theme. The second point I'd make when it comes to precious metals, I mean, you have gold that basically went nowhere for six, almost 7 years after that, after hitting 1900 and some odd US dollars in that big rally, it collapsed and then it went nowhere for 6 years. We're only just now breaking out to the upside, at least recently in gold prices. We're only just now seeing in money, start to come into the mining sector. I mean, how many fund managers out there at these big fund houses have a significant enough allocation to gold or silver miners to actually make a difference in their performance? Probably hardly anyone. So you're going to see a lot of this big money say, shoot, I missed this. I'm missing the beginning of this move. I'm sure as heck not going to miss the middle and the end of it. So you're going to see, in my opinion, dramatically underinvested companies or underinvested managers when it comes to sectors like gold and silver really plow a significant amount of money into it. So, if I had to put it in baseball terms, this is probably only the second or third inning of the move. So there's a lot of game left to be played.
Yeah. Hey, I like baseball and I completely agree. It is about, I would say, the third inning of this potentially long bull market. One final comment, though, and you even mentioned it, is the relative outperformance that we have seen of these safer assets compared to these more risk-on assets when it comes to generalist investors and those that aren't tied to one certain sector or commodity. How important is it to see this outperformance take hold and actually hold now for, close to 6 months, maybe even a year?
Yeah, I mean, it's been going, depending on where you measure it from, I mean, this has really been underway for 12 to 18 months, essentially, where you've seen this outperformance. But it's still, these still aren't the kinds of companies that they're talking about every day on the financial television. They're talking about the latest, money-losing IPO that, sells meat substitutes because it's exciting. When I start hearing them talking about gold miners six times an hour or talking about, why you should invest in treasuries or, hey, here's a utilities IPO, that's when I'll start to get nervous. But you're not seeing any of that. You're not seeing that sort of stuff that you see for any sector or any asset class that you see at the tail end of a bull market when that kind of everybody's in the pool. I think that that's very much not happening. Too much attention is focused on these sort of garbage IPOs, these money-losing companies that capture the public imagination. But are really the exact wrong place to put your money as an investor at this point in the cycle. When that begins to change, that's when I'll start saying, hey, maybe this move's gone too far. But I certainly don't see it yet.
All right, we're going to wrap it up there, Mike. Always great chatting with you. It was actually great spending some time with you, too, at that Sprott Natural Resource Symposium. You were one of those speakers that I think everybody should have gone to because you didn't talk just precious metals focus. You look at the big picture and tie in just how it all plays out for investors, and that's what you do on your, Twitter feed and with your newsletter. So I appreciate you spending all the time you do with us here on the KE Report. Mike, have a great rest of your weekend.
Great. Thank you. Same to you.
Oh, welcome back here to wrap up the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. We are getting a company update from Orin Resources and the executive chairman, Ivan Bebek. Orin is traded on the TSX and on the NYSE under the symbol AUG. Before we get into a number of questions that have come in over the last few weeks, I just want to quickly recap a recent news release. The acquisition of 100% interest in a couple concessions adjacent to a project that the company already holds in southern Peru. Ivan, can you just quickly break down how this acquisition came together, what it means for the company in Peru?
Oh, this was an incredibly opportunistic acquisition for us. We'd been on it for about 3.5 years since we entered Peru. And what drew us into this part of Peru was the mines on this belt, such as Tocopilla, you know, Arequipa, some of the big ones, the 4 to 5 billion ton porphyries. And knowing our group, we really want those big potential discoveries. And so we acquired the first half of it when we first got in Peru. We staked some ground that was dropped by a major mining company in the downturn of the bear market. And we were missing the other half, which had all the copper, gold, and silver on it, as you can see by our recent press release. And, you know, to keep it real simple for now, you know, you've got to think, you know, on a mineral belt that is probably number one in the world for major porphyry deposits occurring. We have copper grades in a porphyry part of the targets that go up to 13.5% copper, and we have gold numbers up to 23 grams gold, as well as an area that has a really, really good silver gold target that has, you know, several multi-kilo up to 14 kilo silver, you know, rocks that have been sampled off the area. So tremendous endowment of copper and gold in one area with a porphyry target that's developing, and a tremendous opportunity for a big gold silver discovery there as well. I think the belt endowment of how big these things can be and the strength of the systems that's seen in the grade are truly going to be exciting for us. We'll start working on this in the fall, and we'll bring it really quickly to a drill-ready stage based on knowing the permitting process inside out now, as we've done it 1.5 times with our projects in Peru. But truly an asset that we were really lucky to get, and once we start sampling it and bringing it to the drill-ready stage, everybody will see why we're so enthused about it.
Okay, now this is early on simply because you just acquired this land, but I recommend everyone going to the Orin Resources website and checking out figure one in that news release, and you can see just how much extra land this has added to that Curibaya concession that the company already held. Now, you already alluded to permitting in Peru, and you've 1.5 times through it already. What updates can you give us in terms of how permitting is going for the projects in Peru? And again, all these kind of loopholes it seems like you need to jump through to get on the ground drilling in Peru.
Sure. So, you know, there's no mystery that there is a fairly elaborate permitting process in Peru. We knew that before we first came to Peru. With Sombrero, it's taken a little longer than most investors would like to appreciate, and I'm sure that affects our share price. However, we delayed it ourselves earlier this year once we got those historical drill holes from the predecessor who drilled some holes at a Furaso concession. And the reason why we intentionally delayed it was because they gave us a fingerprint to the entire system, and they put context around all the other data we collected so we could be far more surgical with where we placed our drill pads. You know, our original pads into the new ones that we've moved them to, wasn't significant in terms of we didn't move it off targets onto different ones, but the equivalent of being a kilometer or two away from the heart of the system or drilling the edge of it was what some of them looked like. So getting that information from those historical drill holes was incredible for value and targeting. Once we implied that, we submitted our permits, and now we're at the stage of waiting for the first major part of permitting, which is the DIA. This is your environmental impact, you know, basically assessment that gives you the first access that you're going to need before you can go and get a social permit. And, you know, we were told recently that it's progressing very well, and we would hope to have resolution on it sometime in September, probably the latest in October. Once this is received, we are expecting to file a social permit. And if you followed our recent PowerPoint update on our website, you know, you'll notice that we've expended about $585,000 US into community programs. A portion of that is funded by us. We've got government NGOs that have helped finance a large portion of that, and the communities have actually contributed as well, which creates a much more sustainable footprint of, you know, a social, you know, respect of social presence, and our community relations have been really positive. This will largely impact our future there as a company, but also the social part of our permit, which can take anywhere from 2 to 4 months. You know, it could be a little bit quicker, but it really comes down to how good you've been with your communities, how much they like you. Once we get the DIA, the government comes in and we'll interview the communities. If they want us to start work immediately, they can push that forward in, you know, 30 to 45 days pretty quickly. So we think that the whole process could be complete before the end of the year. I think there's a reasonable chance that that could very well happen. And we were very pleased to hear the other day that we are progressing well with the first part of the permit. So exciting times. The permit is what we're all waiting for. It is the exciting, you know, the one hesitation before we can drill it. But I promise everyone it's going to come a lot sooner, I think, than we originally anticipated. And we're not complaining about any hoops or delays. We're actually, we're in the system. The system's working. And yeah, it seems to be on track or a bit ahead of schedule. I think the other major factor that you have to look at when you look at Sombrero, because it's such a large land position, is additional community access agreements. And we've been working diligently with surrounding communities to get more access. We hope to have some resolution there in the very near term as well. Hopefully in the next 30 days, we would get access to another large portion of our targets in the land position. And what this would mean for investors is while you're waiting, or while we are waiting for the drill permits to come out, we would likely be able to go surface the next major target, or surface sample the next major targets, and provide the market with even more confidence on a lot of high-grade gold and copper on surface. And the next target we're hoping to go to is got the most robust exposure of copper and gold. You know, a lot of the stuff we've done so far has been little small windows of erosion have given us access to the rocks. This part we're going to, called Neoc, you can see it in our presentation. It's got up to 9% copper and up to 5 gram gold. And you see that in a lot of places that people have found visible gold on it. And there's no shortage of visible copper. So I think a lot of exciting news while waiting will come out of Sombrero. It will continue to get bigger, and it will show the strength of its potential in the system of what it can be while we wait for these permits. We will press release the DIA completion of the permit once that happens. Again, ambitiously September, but conservatively early October. And so look forward to that coming soon.
Okay, so even before, let's say, drill permits are released, we should be getting some sort of an update and some sort of even potential surface work at Sombrero before the end of the year. Is that an accurate summary?
Yeah, I'd say we're hoping to be back on ground in September. And so we would be getting results out pretty quickly. And, you know, this just happens to be the next area we're hoping to get access to, happens to be the most exposed, the richest part of the system that's exposed. So this should be exciting numbers for all of us to look forward to. And yeah, it's exciting times. And moving forward, it's going to be a really busy Q4 for Sombrero, and hopefully permit in hand, you know, sometime later in Q4.
Okay. I don't think there's much more to cover in terms of Peru and Sombrero, but let's also talk about Committee Bay drilling. It is that season when you can get the drills on site. What updates can you give us here?
Sure. So we just finished drilling, and we're waiting in the Rankin is where we send all of our drill core before it gets shipped out on a commercial flight to Vancouver. It'll go to ALS Chemex here. So we've completed our drilling. We drilled a modest program, about 8 holes. I'd say that there's a portion of those holes that look awesome. They have a really good shot to be what we're looking for, probably 3 or 4 out of the 8 holes. The other ones are a bit of a lottery. You don't know what you're going to get. It's one of those parts of the world that until you get assays, you truly don't know. And last year we thought we drilled this massive discovery and we got a gold and we hit a hydrothermal system, but not enough gold was the challenge there. In this case, this year, we've tested some of our AI targets. And we've gone back and we've offset, meaning we've moved further down the trend from where we were having the success last year. So no, we're very excited about it. I mean, it's a small program. A lot of people will ask, you know, how impactful would this be if you missed it? My father did the entire financing for it, so I only have one person on the financing side to deal with if we miss. But at the same time, if we did get it right and we did hit, you know, start to hit more grade and more widths than we did last year, then, you know, sky's the limit on what it could be up there, and it would be tremendously exciting. I think, you know, from a share price perspective, you know, there's a lot of anticipation on how the AI is working, and I think there will most certainly be a very positive impact from the AI that we've been using. I also think that, you know, the success we had last year will pour towards some more success this year, possibly enough to be excited about something that really gets started. If it's a complete miss and if there's nothing there, you know, it's exploration, there's risk, and Committee Bay is a tough place to go look for it. We didn't dilute too much to do it, but the second major point there is we'll be coming out with our Peruvian permit on Sombrero. The first major portion of our Peruvian permit should be announced around the same time, and we'll be giving, you know, surface results from Sombrero as well. That'll be making it bigger at the same time. So I think you have a really soft landing if it's not there, if not a reason to be more excited about Sombrero ramping up if the worst case scenario happened and it was blank. But at the same time, I'm an optimist, as everyone knows, and, you know, I love it when they drill next to high-grade gold in the Arctic and go for big systems. And, you know, again, a few of the holes look really good, and we'll see what happens.
Okay. No, as you said, hey, exploration, you don't know what you're going to get. But you did also say that some of these holes have a really good chance of finding what you're looking for. Can you elaborate? What are you exactly looking for? What would make you the most happy?
Well, if we can hit 100 GT hole, meaning 10 meters of 10 grams, 20 meters of 5 grams, or 5 meters of 20 grams, anything, if you take the grade of the hole times the width of the hole, that's 100 grams per ton or close to that, you know, anywhere from 70 to 100 grams per ton or better. If we start to see that, it would be very confirmatory that you might be into a potential bigger system, and it would draw a lot more attention to drilling more next year. Why 100 grams per ton is important? It's, you know, to be really non-technical about it, it's very hard for the earth to produce 100 grams per ton in a drill hole. And usually when you're onto a discovery, you have 300 or 400 grams per ton drill holes that occur. And once you see those, you're generally into a bona fide discovery. By experience, Keegan, our first company, we found a 5 million ounce deposit in Ghana, West Africa. We had about 600 or 700 gram per ton holes across that entire project, right? And so once we started to see those holes showing up, we knew that we were going to be into a system that could end up being a potential mine. With Caden in Mexico, our last company, we started to hit those 100 gram per ton holes as well. It led to the purchase by Agnico Eagle. And, you know, it's not a guarantee, but it's a pretty good rule of thumb on metrics in any deposit that once you get into that kind of equivalent of an economic drill hole, potentially, that you're onto potentially a mine. If you take the 116 meters of 0.58 we sampled at Sombrero and the Firasso target, that's 100 plus 100 gram per ton in a hole. So that already has one of those holes that matter. So yeah, anything, if you see anything to that extent like that come out of our program, I think it's going to be a tremendous success for us. And it would most certainly warrant, you know, a very exciting continuation in this new gold market that we're all enjoying.
All right. Yes, this new gold market does change some things for juniors, well, for all gold companies, but it's not like we've seen just a broad-based recovery. So something to consider that focus on kind of the stocks that do have stuff going for them and companies that are able to advance projects. That takes us to our next question that I've been getting a fair bit of that deals mostly with financing. Are you going to go to market for a financing, or are we going to see some sort of an asset sale? Tying in also with that uptrend in gold, what can you share with us here?
Sure. Great question. And that most certainly is the big elephant in the room, because our treasury in our last financials end of July was $1.9 million, which most certainly won't carry us forward. We won't go to market, to answer your question first and foremost, because we don't agree with the valuation of our share price. And we think we have enough meaningful catalysts in front of us that could re-rate our share price considerably. That being said, an asset sale would be an option. You know, I've talked about them a year ago, and everyone's heard me speculate on them. If you listened to me in the spring, I did comment that we anticipate higher metal prices, and now we have them. Even though the junior mining companies' share prices haven't gone up much since this gold move, but when you start talking towards asset sales and you talk about outlook on potential commodity prices, you know, that table has certainly turned dramatically. We were talking about selling an asset at 1360 gold. Gold went to 1280. Gold's now at 1500 and change. It certainly changed that opportunity. So I would say for everyone listening, you know, if you're looking at buying an asset as an entrepreneur, as an executive in a mining company, you got to ask yourself this question: is gold going to go up or down in 12 months from today? You know, silver going to go up or down in 12 months from today? And I think from paneling a few analysts in the last few days, the unanimous answer is absolutely everyone confirmed that they believe it's going to go up, right? And so when that's a factor, you have two choices. Are you going to buy the asset at today's prices, or do you want to pay more for it in a year from now at much higher prices, right? And I think that's the one thing that really puts logic into transactions, not just with us, but with others able to happen right now. We're obviously active with both of ours that we've considered selling with the new commodity prices with multiple parties. And so, you know, I think that the chance of that happening is real. And, you know, alternatively to that, we've had a lot of corporate interest on our project in Peru. Do we pursue investment that way? That's another option. You know, part of us is we're a little bit conservative until we get to drill it ourselves, because we think a lot of value can come. But the other main catalyst for us in Q4 will be getting a drill permit in hand. And so asset sales, a drill permit in hand, that's, you know, may keep you away from the market entirely, or it may make you 10 times more financeable at a better price because you can drill 2 weeks after you raise the money. To avoid the market, if we don't make an asset sale at this time, we would likely fund it ourselves by some way of a bridge or whatnot, and give us 6 or 7 months working capital so that we can continue our activities in Peru, get our drill permits in hand, and make the two asset sales that we're considering doing. So either way, I hate to disappoint the bankers, but we're not going to go to market. We're not going to do a financing with a warrant. We're going to stay away from that, and we're going to keep ourselves very anti-dilutive and look towards potential asset sales and getting drill permits in hand to reestablish a much better rating for our current share price value before we entertain any kind of public type of financing.
Okay, Ivan, I appreciate you fielding that question, because I know I've been getting that a fair bit. So that was a pretty comprehensive answer. If anybody has any follow-up questions, please email me, fleck@kereport.com. Happy to get those in front of Ivan and get your questions answered. Sounds like there should be quite a bit of news coming out until the end of the year, and then even into next year, some drilling still to come in Peru. But step by step, you need to jump through those hoops and get all the permits that are needed. In the meantime, though, Ivan, please keep us up to date. Everybody, I do appreciate you tuning in to this weekend show. I also appreciate all the comments we get day after day and all the emails I get on companies and for our guests. Please keep them coming. I love hearing from all of you. Ivan, thanks for your time this weekend. Have a great rest of your weekend.
You as well. Thank you.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.